The world's experts on bears are coming together in Alaska, where bear habitat is still extensive, which is not the case in much of the world. I'm Steve Heimel. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. As human population expands, how real is the risk that our top predators will go extinct? Our phone number, 1-800-478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage of 550-8422. How do we manage to coexist with bears is the subject on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
ExxonMobil Alaska, working with more than 100 Alaska communities and thousands of Alaskans. Today, ExxonMobil is producing natural gas condensate from the Point Thompson facilities. Alaska's tobacco quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, so the International Association for Bear Research and Management, known as the IBA for some reason, is about to meet. It's an international convention. It takes place every 18 months, and it happens in various places around the world, and this time it's going to be in Anchorage, Alaska, and anticipation is already building up. People are already arriving in town, and a number of events have been scheduled to go kind of along with this big international meeting of biologists and managers and specialists. So it seemed like a great time to do a radio show to chime in on the rest of it, because Alaska's in a special situation with regards to bears. I.e., we've got a lot of habitat and not so many people, and so maybe Alaska can be a place where examples can be set, where we can, as we often say about Alaska, we can find a way to do it right. Well, we're also the only Arctic state in the United States, and so we have a situation with our sea ice, which is a very concerning matter to Alaska. So we'll particularly be talking about polar bears. And we have a fabulous panel. With us is, I guess we'll start with Dave Garshelis of the Department of Natural Resources, State of Minnesota. He's up in the northern part of the state where the forest is. And he is also the keeper of the Red List. He is the bear co-chairman for the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, and he's also a professor, an adjunct professor at University of Minnesota, where he supervises and advises a number of graduate students all over the world dealing with the various species of bears. And Dave, I was shocked to discover there were so many species of bears.
Yeah, there's eight, Steve. Some people actually think that there's, you know, 25 or 30 different species of bears, but there are eight.
And so we've got bears in, like, Borneo. We got bears in Afghanistan, Pakistan. We've got bears in South America, Japan, places I didn't really know, India. And it seems to me that, you know, because of expanding human population, that in a lot of cases, you know, they're tipping towards the endangered end of the Red List.
Yeah, that's right, Steve. We have bears every place except Australia and Africa. And actually used to be some bears in Africa, but they're gone. But in a lot of the places, in particularly South America and Asia, the bears are not faring very well. And a lot of poaching going on, a lot of habitat loss, forest cutting, conversion of forest to crops like palm oil and rubber. And an intolerance for bears, and also these bears are way more aggressive than our bears. They tend to attack, some of them at least, tend to attack people more, and people don't like living with bears like that.
Yeah, we're getting some kind of click on your phone line. I think we're going to try and reestablish, call you again. It may be that there's some kind of scanning machine of some sort that's putting out a little microwave beam or something, but it's pretty, it's really hitting our line, so I think we'll try and get you back again, Dave. So thanks. Just stay with us, and we'll call you back at your number, okay? Okay. We're already doing it. Well, I'll turn to the studio here where Steve Amstrup, who I think used to work right down the street at the U.S. Geological Survey in charge of the polar bear program, is back in the state now. He is now the chief scientist for Polar Bears International. Steve, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you, Steve. It's good to be here and good to be back in Alaska.
I'll bet. This is the best time of year for it,
yes,
as
it
you
is.
Well know. So is this, what is our situation with polar bears? It's pretty clear that we've got probably the worst year for sea ice this year ever. And they've been pretty bad for a while. And we have bears very challenged. Do we have, I mean, this is a vast area up here. And how much do we actually know about how well or poorly the polar bear is doing in the Alaskan part of the Beaufort?
Well, I think we can say pretty clearly that we've got a problem in Alaska, and particularly in the Beaufort Sea. Some of my colleagues and I published a paper last year where we documented an approximately 40% decline in the population of the southern Beaufort Sea just in the first decade of the 2000s. But I think it's also really important to look at the fact that polar bears throughout their range, and they have what's called a circumpolar distribution. They live all around the globe in the Arctic regions. So if you looked at the top of the world, you know, pretty much everything you could see in that projection would be potentially polar bear habitat. But they depend on the sea ice for capturing their prey. And the sea ice is declining. Polar bears, unlike all the other bears, live on a habitat that literally melts as the temperatures rise. And global temperatures have been rising steadily and will continue to rise as long as greenhouse gas concentrations continue to increase. So we have, in some places like northern Alaska, an urgent situation where the population has been declining. But in the bigger picture, we have globally, some populations may still be doing all right. But if we don't change our ways, eventually all of the habitat will melt and all of the polar bears will be in a similar situation to those in Alaska.
So it wouldn't be like, a sudden extinction. It would be more a case of going down to where the habitat was fragmented and to where the genetic effects start, bottlenecks and so forth, start being a problem.
Yeah, like, I mean, we're going to see... Yeah, that's one thing that people often get confused is that they just lump all polar bears in the world together. And we're going to see different geographic responses as the climate warms. You know, there are parts of the Arctic that are cooler, parts of the Arctic that are warmer. Those that are the warmest are likely to be most at risk. But also the situation in Alaska is really dependent on the circulation of the polar basin, sea ice and the ocean currents. And so part of our problem in Alaska is that the ice forms here and is constantly being moved out into the center of the polar basin. So it's taking whatever ice there is away from the productive nearshore habitat. The other side of the polar basin, it's piling up. So there might be the place where we would expect polar bears to persist the longest. But eventually the ice would be gone there as well.
So I was looking through the literature and was it known, say, 10 years ago, how far a polar bear could swim? And is it known now?
Well, we have a really good example of one bear that the USGS, George Derner was the leader of this project, instrumented a bear with a number of different electronic instruments and was able to document its transport through a radio collar and then a number of physiological responses. And that bear swam over 400 miles over a 9-day period and was apparently in the water continuously, as near as we could tell. And so we know that they can swim a long distance, but not without expense. That bear lost 20% of its body weight and also lost its yearling cub. So its cub was apparently unable to make that long swim. So the fact that they can, under the right circumstances, swim a long ways, and whether or not that's good for them, are two different things. And we do have some evidence that with rough sea conditions, polar bears can also drown. They aren't aquatic animals. We consider them marine mammals, but they aren't aquatic animals like seals or whales, and rough seas can be a problem for them.
How about the quality of their prey in terms of their habitat? In other words, the status of the seals that they feed on. I mean, if the sea ice is blown away as it has, I mean, I guess the last I heard, there's a little bit of sea ice stuck on the Cooper Island. The rest of it was way out there now, this year. So the polar bears are either on shore or over there with that pack ice. And what are they finding to eat?
Well, that's the problem, is studies show pretty clearly that there isn't enough food on land over most of the Arctic to support polar bears. And we have hypothesized for some time that the distant sea ice that remains over very deep water is also not very productive from the standpoint of biological productivity, as well as whether or not there are seals there for the polar bears to catch.
I see. So the seal habitat is not necessarily really good over the deeper water, is it?
That's right. That's right. I mean, the deep polar basin water is very unproductive. Depending on what part of the Arctic you're talking about, 50 to 90% of the Arctic Ocean productivity occurs in that narrow band of shallow water right near shore. And north of Alaska, that narrow band, the continental shelf, is the narrowest of any place in the Arctic. So there's some perhaps good things about that, but from the standpoint of a polar bear, from the standpoint of biological productivity, it's not so good. And we recently have new data that are just coming out that actually seem to affirm our hypotheses that polar bears that have to spend the summer way out in the distant pack ice are not finding much to eat.
And that would be bad for a reproductive situation.
That's right. And that's something that's really, I think, an important take-home message about climate change compared to some other threats. You know, historically, the main thing that we were concerned about with polar bears and many of the bear species has been how they are harvested, what numbers and what the sex and age of the animals that are hunted what is the composition of the sex and age in the harvest. And we've always said, well, we need to protect the females because they're the ones that can produce the babies. So in the hunting season, it tends to favor the males and try and protect those females. Well, that's still, of course, the case if we're talking about hunting. But habitat loss actually impacts the young first, because bears are large animals. They live a long time. They learn about their environment. If conditions are bad, it's the adults that are the most likely to be able to figure out how to make a living. But the youngsters are not going to make it. And so if you have year after year after year of bad conditions, then you don't have the young coming along, and pretty soon the population tops out, and when all the old folks out there tip over, that's it.
Well, I'm kind of an old folk myself.
Nothing personal there, Steve.
I just had to say it. We're talking to Steve Amstrup. He is the chief scientist of Polar Bears internationally. He's in town for a meeting. There's actually a polar bear meeting that precedes the IBA, I'm going to call it, even though it's actually called the the International Association of Bear Research and Management. I think I got it right. Also with us is Margaret Williams. She is the director of the U.S. Arctic Program for the World Wildlife Fund, which is a NGO that is quite I would say, pretty intimately involved with this entire bear situation. Is that right, Margaret?
Absolutely. Good morning, Steve.
Yeah, good morning and welcome back to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you. Yes, World Wildlife Fund is very involved in bear conservation, particularly polar bear conservation in the Arctic, but also we work on the conservation and management of particular habitats that are important to bears, such as Bristol Bay. That's been a real important place for World Wildlife Fund in the last several years.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to bring that up about Bristol Bay, but first let me get a little overview on the events of the next week, 2 weeks, really, because there's all these other things that are going on. We've got like kind of a bear, almost a bear month here. And all these managers and biologists and so forth are coming into town, and we already heard that Steve is and Dave, I think both are meeting together on some polar bear working group assembly. And then I know there's a bunch of public events that are happening as the convention goes on, and some that are happening ahead of time, including a storytelling session at the Beartooth Theater, oddly named the Beartooth Theater, and people are going to tell their bear stories. And Steve, I guess you're going to tell one of yours?
Yeah, I'm going to tell a story.
Wow. and so they have you gone through the process yet? Does anybody know what your story is?
Do
you know?
Don't tell. It should be a surprise.
Don't blow it.
But it is a true story.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They're going to be true as you remember it. That's important. I've done these things. Otherwise, you've got to do research and fact-checking. And
yeah.
That can be a bit much. Yeah, so you're one event, and there'll be other people, but they're not necessarily all professionals or anything like that, as I understand, that will be telling their stories in the manner of the people in Anchorage know this Arctic Entries program, and there's a bunch of kind of spin-offs and imitators that are coming along, and they're doing the same thing. It's really wonderful. You get just citizens, people that you may already know, and they get up there in front of a big audience, and then they're nervous. But some of them can really pull it off, and they tell a story to a whole audience of people. It's just absolutely wonderful. I mean, it makes me real happy as a broadcaster.
Well, it is going to be a really fun week. We have this incredible group of experts, over 400 people, I think, or close to 400 people have registered for this International Bear Association conference.
Whoa.
So people from all over the world are coming. One of our experts for World Wildlife Fund, who's a panda expert, is coming from China. Brown bear experts, all kinds of folks.
The Russians are coming this time?
There are some Russians. Russians are coming as well. There's a woman who's going to speak about bears in Kamchatka, which is, of course, just across the Bering Sea from Alaska. But we had the organizing committee has done an incredible job to try to bring the information to the public as well. So there are going to be public lectures in the evening next week. As you mentioned, there's the bear storytelling at the Beartooth Theater on Thursday of this week. There's also going to be, it's coming a little bit later, but as part of this celebration of bears, there's going to be something called Bears on Parade. And you remember maybe Chicago, different cities have taken on a sort of mascot. I think Chicago had bulls or cows, mm-hmm. and actually Washington, D.C. did panda bears a long time ago, and artists come out and paint them, and we're going to have a whole series of bears designed by local artists, which will be appearing, I think, in the coming month. So it should be a lot of fun. There are going to be bear book authors also at the conference. And it's really been a big effort by the organizing committee to bring bears to the people and not just have these esoteric, very focused talks. Not that science is esoteric, but sometimes it's a little bit hard for the average person to digest. So it should be a great week.
Yeah. And scientifically, Steve Amstrup, is this the big thing for if you're in a bear world, this is the thing you go to?
Yeah, I think that's true. I'm, you know, because they're held in different places around the world, every conference has a slightly different composition of people. But what you can always count on is that there will be a good representation of people who are interested in research and management of bears all around the world, all eight species. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to have this conference here in Alaska, I think it was in Alaska last in 1995. And it's been all over the world since then. And so having it come back to Alaska now is a really good thing. And the public part of it looks to me like it's going to be bigger this time than it ever has been, which is really important because, as Margaret said, you know, us scientists, we can get together and talk to each other. But unless we convey the information to the general public, how is that ever going to do anything for us? Because it's the general public and the policymakers that we really have to communicate with in order to have people understand what the challenges are that face bears.
And I would think that in what they are calling these days best practices, that is really, I mean, there's a lot of frontier there. There's a lot of best practices now appearing, you know, as human bear conflicts and habitat issues get more severe, that there are people that are doing the numbers and also figuring out ways of successful management. And Margaret, I guess you've got a few examples.
Well, I think we do, and Steve was talking about the dire situation with polar bear habitat and the loss of sea ice, and we've seen some really innovative community-based solutions with respect to managing the oncoming or the expected problem of polar bears spending more time on land, both in Russia in a small village in the Russian Arctic in the region of Chukotka, which is right across from the Bering, from Alaska via the Bering Strait. We saw a tiny community realizing they didn't want to have to shoot polar bears that were coming into town. But they certainly didn't want to risk losing children or having any human mortality. And so they created a polar bear patrol. And they really didn't have many resources at their fingertips, but they, and I can explain in more detail what they did, but they sort of took control of the situation to protect the bears and the people alike. World Wildlife Fund is working with the Village of Whales in Alaska, which is just doing some wonderful preparations in anticipation of bears coming into the village. We work closely with the North Slope Borough, which has a great program to address polar bears coming into town. They're just really on top of it. Kaktovik is doing some great work to manage the annual gathering of polar bears in their village. So it's been very exciting to see the community-based solutions, and World Wildlife Fund is really happy to support that work.
Yeah, I think when they take tourists on the haul road to Prudhoe Bay, that they have to be vigilant about polar bears. I mean, it's part of the business because because they are on shore. And I know the last time I hosted this program this winter, George Duvoki was on, and he is on Cooper Island researching this colony of birds. And he was concerned this year about the waves are starting to wash over the island now. And he has a little cabin that he uses to shelter himself and his graduate students that work with him as they do their sampling of these birds all through the summer. And they weren't sure exactly what they were going to do. He's thinking about maybe I need some kind of ark or something, some cabin that would float to keep this thing going. But he's already had to. I mean, the polar bears are on shore on Cooper Island now, off of Barrow, and they'll eat any bird that they can find. So if he's going to keep his birds alive, he has to protect them. He has this. Has these little protective boxes that the bears can't get into. And I would think maybe you know, I don't know, or you, Steve, what's going on with the birds on Wrangell Island. That could be rather dire, I would think.
Well, there are places around the Arctic where cliff nesting birds, ground nesting birds are being severely affected by polar bear predation. bears being on shore for a much longer period than historically. They're hungry, and they'll find just about anything to eat. It's an interesting situation in that most of these cases, like Cooper Island, the impact of the bears on the birds can be really severe, but the nutritional impact of the birds on the bears is probably not very significant at all. It's just something that they can get, but we can't expect it to support bear populations.
No, I wouldn't think so.
And so it's important to remember that. Now, there has been observations of bears, of polar bears coming ashore and catching the odd snow goose and eating snow goose eggs, et cetera, in Hudson Bay. And there's an abundance of those geese, but the timing and such still makes it pretty clear that there isn't a situation there that can support polar bears in the long run.
So we're going to get some of these density things like you have with the ungulates, with say, the caribou, where dealing with predation, your numbers are important. The birds have always had that, you know, the flocking thing. Well, that's great. I understand Dave Garshelis is back with us from Minnesota. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Steve. I'm back. I'm hoping there's no clicking anymore.
There is no clicking. It's totally gone. And we're really glad of that. It's good to have you back on the program. Can you give me some idea? Are you going to get to go to the IBA at all, or did I hear that you're just in and out?
Oh, sure. No, I'm going to be at the IBA, and I'm giving one of the public lectures on Wednesday evening.
Oh, great. And can you give us some idea what you're going to...
I'm going to be talking about the four least known species of bears in the world. So that's the Asiatic black bear, sun bear, sloth bear, and Andean bear. Trying to give the audience some perspective on the issues impacting those bears and attempts that conservationists and bear biologists have made to try to reverse the threats that are impacting those species, which are, you know, kind of unique. I mean, they're different than we see in North America, and cultures are very different, and you have to have an appreciation for, you know, being a poor person living in a place where there's bears marauding your crops or possibly even threatening your life, and how what it would be like to live in that situation. And it's not just coming in and talking to the person and telling them that they need to tolerate the bears. It's a much more complex situation.
Have you
got very big companies that are in, you know, doing logging and converting a lot of land to oil palm, which is the main agricultural product of Malaysia and Indonesia, and how that impacts the bears as well.
So that would be sun bear.
Yeah, that would be sun bear and also Asiatic black bears in the Thailand and Myanmar and Vietnam, Cambodia.
I see. Have you seen the Jungle Book, though, of Disney movie?
Yes, a long time ago.
I know, there's a new one out.
Oh, I haven't seen the new one.
They have much better animatronics, and the reason I bring it up is just because I always thought Kipling was just making that up about bears in the jungles of India, but it turns out there is a bear in the jungle of India. And so it's a very well-known character in the Jungle Book. Baloo is the bear that gets Mowgli to go fetch him honey and so forth. And there actually is a bear in the jungles of India.
Yeah, and that, and Baloo is actually, even though he's the wrong color, but he's a sloth bear. And a sloth bear, the scientific name of a sloth bear is Melursus or Cynus. Mel means honey, so it's honey bear. So that sort of fits, but actually the sloth bear is almost entirely an insect eater. They focus in on termites and ants.
So it's a carnivore, but just little meats.
Yeah, little tiny packages.
But lots of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yes, I was thinking, so it's probably not just the honey, but the bees too.
Yeah, and they're missing their front two teeth, the front two incisors, and they suck the termites up through there. They have a giant vacuum system that they can suck these things up. Huh. And it would seem like a bear that eats primarily ants on termites wouldn't be very dangerous, but this is probably the most dangerous species of bear in the world.
Is that right? Why? Because of the claws?
Well, they do it. They have really big canines. They're really big. The claws are for digging up the termite mounds, and the canines are probably for fighting tigers. And since they live in a very open habitat where they encounter tigers a bunch, these are bears with really low tolerance. And they meet people out in a rice field or something like that, and they're just extremely aggressive. More so, way more so than our grizzly bears.
Is this one of those situations in India where the poorest people are the ones that are most exposed to the wild animals? They have really no power over it. They just, some distant government is making the policy decisions.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in fact, these bears, they kind of live up in these boulder fields that are sort of along the edge of villages, places where people can't farm, but it's places where the bears can go up there and get out of the heat. They basically hunker down in these little caves all day, and in the evening they come down to get something to eat, look for termite mounds and eat some crops, and there's some people out there. Sometimes they're just out in their field going to the bathroom, and this, bear comes down in sort of dusky hours, and it's usually not a good situation.
Yeah, I have to say that Bill Murray does the voice of Baloo in this movie. I'll say out of nowhere. Well, thank you. We're talking to Dave Garcelles, who was actually the bear co-chairman of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, one of a number of managers and scientists who are coming to Anchorage for the IBA, the Bear Management Conference, a big international conference happening here next week. Dennis and Kodiak, hang in there. We'll be with you as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The Business Administration Program at Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive education grounded in real-world experience with life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Move forward with APU and apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettesworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
Frosty Mountain Boy is an old slew foot right here on Talk of Alaska. The telephone number 1-800-478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. And we're talking with a great panel, but I really want to start rolling the calls here into the program because there's so much that has changed. And the listeners to this program are actually experiencing this change, and I'm sure have plenty of things to say. Dennis joins the program from Kodiak. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Dennis.
Jamai, Mr. Heimel, what a treat to hear you back on the air. I'll make it real quick after I get over my Petri Bear Jamboree flashback from your music there. Anyway, a question and a story. I never heard a follow-up on those big brown Bruins that were over in, I believe, Siberia, killing and eating guards of a mine Maybe some of your resource listeners are familiar with that story, but they were described as 1,500-pound killing in a pack like wolves. But anyway, hearing you dial in on the polar bear scene, and you can just imagine living on the Emerald Isle for 21 years, how many bear stories I have. But I've been carrying this article around in my briefcase. It's a reprint. And as steeped as you are in Alaska history, Mr. Heimel, I'm sure you probably heard this story. It was September 4th, 1943. Polar bear wanders far to Kodiak Isle, is killed. I actually met a gentleman, friend of his family, who lived to be 100, who actually saw this bear before he was shot. Wow. But it says here the bear was seen first on Kodiak Island in the Uyak Bay region by the crew of a fishing boat. It was swimming the sea and climbed onto a rock. It was then observed on Seven Mile Beach, where it broke into a camp. It was shot two different times before it was finally killed.
Wow.
The hide was brought to town and compared to a Kodiak brown bear in the Bank of Kodiak, where the differences in the shape of the head, legs, and body proved it was a polar bear. You know, holy cow, you know, the truth is better than fiction.
It is indeed, Dennis, and there's your documentation right there of what we thought that we had just discovered, how far these bears can swim.
Yeah, unfortunately, that adolescent had to get whacked in my neighborhood here by Mill Bay a few weeks back. It was obviously just kicked, you know, out of mom's nest, and it was too friendly. You know, it was it would hear people talking and approach them. And, it was just inevitable. And then some ding-dong fed it, and next thing you know, it wandered into their house. It wanted to, you know, peel the layers of their home back to get some more. And unfortunately, we have such an abundant overpopulation, probably the greatest big game animal on earth management skills. And I'm sure you're real familiar with that. It's pretty interesting how taking the big trophy boars explode the population. They're the number one killers of their own kind. But wonderful show. I'm sure you've got the phones lit up. And again, good to hear your voice back on the air.
Hey, Dennis, thanks for the call from the Emerald Isle on Talk of Alaska, 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. And we'll turn... I want to go to this issue of polar bears on shore, because we also know the walrus are going on shore. And I'm thinking over in Siberia, we could have some trouble with that. Does either one of you, Margaret Williams or Steve Amstrup, have any idea of the status on this?
Well, I can start. So we do know that polar bears, under the right circumstances, will prey on walruses. And often the preying strategy is they approach a group of walruses that's hauled out on land. The walruses are scared. They stampede into the water and they run over each other, killing and injuring each other, especially the calves. And so that provides a dead or nearly dead food source on the beach for polar bears. And we know that that happens in some places. It's been observed in Alaska. It's been observed on the Russian side. But I think the important thing to remember is that that probably isn't a long-term source of food for at the population level for polar bears. And it certainly is detrimental to walruses, which are already stressed out because historically Pacific walruses floated around on the ice in the Chukchi Sea all summer long, and the ice was constantly carrying them over new fresh habitat to feed on the bottom of the ocean. And now they're increasingly stuck in places on land where they have to swim out sometimes dozens or hundreds of miles to find a place to feed. So they're already in a situation that's less desirable than it otherwise might have been from a nutritional standpoint. And then on top of that, the odd polar bear comes through and whacks a few of them.
Yeah. Margaret, anything to add in that, on the Russian side there?
Sure, yeah. We have... been hearing since the early 2000s of very large haulouts, areas where walruses are coming ashore, mothers and their calves, on the Chukotkin coast. And actually, the community that I mentioned, this tiny village on the Russian Arctic coast, was inspired to create the Polar Bear Patrol because they had a very large group of walruses coming ashore, 20,000 walruses just within almost spitting distance of their village. And the walruses were stampeding, as Steve described, leaving calves and small adults behind. And that's just a perfect attractant for polar bears. So that was one of the reasons why they really wanted to organize themselves to keep the polar bears away from these carcasses. Wow. They actually ended up moving some of the walrus carcasses away from the village to sort of distract the polar bears along their migratory route. And by the time the polar bears were coming into their village, they were fat and happy and really didn't bother the villagers at all.
I guess we're speaking about a fairly restricted period of time.
Yes, that's in late August. And yeah. But as Steve said, the walruses are so highly dependent on sea ice, just like polar bears. And we've seen large hollowouts forming up near Point Lay, and the community of Point Lay has done an incredible job to work with aviation and keep the disturbance away from the hollowout because they're such skittish animals. And they're working with the Fish and Wildlife Service and scientists and trying to figure out how they can best reduce disturbance to the walruses while they're ashore.
You mentioned Bristol Bay before, and I would note, I heard a story from Dave Bettinger that it's not just Round Island where the males are hauling out anymore. There's other places now.
That's true. And I think this is not, I actually don't know all of the story why they're doing that, but there was a story a while ago about a new haulout on the Alaska Peninsula. Yeah. So maybe they've overgrazed where they had been earlier. But Bristol Bay, yes, I just wanted to say something about that because we are so lucky in Alaska. We have incredibly intact habitat for so many species. And we have an opportunity to look ahead and think, how do we do our best job to protect that? And considering climate change, considering the rapid change in habitat and vegetation, we really need to do our best to ensure that that's going to stay intact and resilient. And a place like Bristol Bay, gosh, there's just no place like it in the world. We have millions, 30 million salmon filling those waters. We have bears and eagles and people all living together in this intact ecosystem. So it really is a globally significant and special place.
Yeah, it's interesting bear habitat.
Absolutely. Very special.
We are seeing, I don't know, maybe Dave Garcellis can help us on this, but here in Alaska, I know that increasingly bear viewing has become an economic factor in the visitor industry. And it's been discovered that you don't have to be all that scared of these bears if you know their ways and the situation is managed well. It's actually possible for people to get quite close to the bears. So the bears are already like eating fish. They're just not all interested in people. And this has happened at Peck Creek. It's happened at McNeil. It's, Katmai is a little bit of a different situation. But even there, I think the management has become more compatible. And it's just been discovered that this is a viable thing. I'm wondering about other places in the world. Is this happening? Is bear viewing actually becoming something that is developed as a industry and enterprise, Dave?
Well, it's most popular in Alaska, Steve, because you have these places where the bears are concentrated, and that's, of course, if you're going to do some bear viewing, you want to go to a place where you see a bunch of bears, and you don't want to just stand out in the woods and wait for an odd bear to walk by. So it's actually not that popular in a lot of places. Actually, where I live, there's a black bear viewing place, but they have to provide artificial food for them in order to get them concentrated enough for people to view them. There are a number of places in Europe that are bear viewing places, but again, they tend to be places with like bear feeders. They put out these bear feeders, and the bears come and congregate, and then people can go there and take pictures of them. In most of the rest of the world, in Asia and such, this kind of a thing is absent.
Yeah, well, I know back in Pennsylvania, there was in northern Pennsylvania, where the woods were coming back in hardwoods after the clear cutting at the turn of the century, we had overpopulation of deer, and we didn't have a whole lot of bear. But the one place, if there were going to be bear, would be the dump. It would be the dump. And I think that's kind of a common situation all over the world. Steve Amstrup?
Yeah, I wanted to add a follow-up to Dave's comment, is that one of the things about bears is that over most of their range, most of the time, bears live at very low densities. Even in the places where we think of bears being very abundant, like in Alaska, they're relatively uncommon compared to lots of the other creatures out there. The reason bear viewing is possible here is because we have these tremendous food concentrations of the salmon streams. We have anadromous fish that all run up at the same time and spawn, and then they die, and they, you know, it's just a tremendous nutritional food source. In other parts of the world, there may be food in the streams, for example, but it doesn't come in such a pulse. Atlantic salmon, for example, and char do not run all together. And so they don't provide that same concentrated food source. And out in the jungle or out in the forest, the food sources are pretty dispersed. And that's why the bears are, for the most part, pretty dispersed. And so the bear viewing situation, it would be wonderful if there was opportunity to do it. But, providing artificial food for bears is probably not the best way to go to encourage bear viewing.
Yeah, Dave, I appreciate that insight on the big picture. I think it's isn't it Romania where they really have this situation where people actually they have to hunt the bears or they get overpopulated in the small range that they have.
Well, there's actually a lot of controversy regarding that in Romania, with trying to thin the population and their quotas being high and maybe getting the army involved and everything else. But they do have. They do have bear viewing there, but it is, again, just these supplemental feeders. They have a lot of bear viewing in Finland, and again, it's supplementally fed bears. I will add, though, I've been to an interesting place in India where they have bear viewing of sloth bears when they wake up in the evening and they come down out of these hillocky areas I was mentioning, and they run up there during the day while the bears are all sleeping, and they paint the rocks with honey. And then the bears wake up, and as they come down, they stop and lick the honey, and so you see a bunch of bears licking the rocks.
I was thinking you were going to say, they have clusters of termite mounds, so they get everybody hangs around there. No, no such luck. That's pretty substantial baiting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll get back to the subject as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
It's Talk of Alaska, the subject, the always fascinating topic of bears. And Kim joins the program from Palmer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Kim.
Hi, thank you. My question is, a number of years ago, I did a sea kayaking trip up in the far Canadian north around Baffin Island and Admiralty and saw a number of polar bears and occasionally a grizzly bear. And I know Canadian Geographic has documented several cases where polar bears have crossbred with grizzly bears up there, and that those bears are not only hunting seals, but also eating the far north type of salmon that they have up there. And I wondered if you see that possibly happening to the population as it gets more stressed here on the west coast of Alaska.
Steve Amstrup?
Well, I think that... We probably, as the climate continues to warm, we will see more brown bears adjacent areas where polar bears occur, and we are likely to see more interbreeding. That's one interesting thing about brown bears and polar bears. We always have known that they're very closely related, and they can interbreed. So will that occur? It probably will occur more frequently. We know from the genetic history, new molecular genetic techniques have shown us that polar bears and brown bears have interbred over the course of the evolutionary history of the brown bear. So it's not a brand new thing, but it may be more frequent now. The important thing to remember, though, is that if we're concerned about the preservation of polar bears as the current life form, the magnificent white bears that roam around on the surface of the ice, that's a different preservation or conservation topic than hoping that there will be a few polar bear genes roaming around in an animal that looks like a grizzly bear. So I think we need to keep to understand that, yes, it probably will happen more frequently, but it isn't really the salvation of polar bears.
Kim?
I see. What do you think that as polar bears, of course, since they're not on the ice now, are getting far less seals to eat as they used to, do they easily transfer to another food source, such as fish or whatever?
No, that's something that we haven't seen very frequently. And in fact, my colleagues and I just recently published a paper showing that around the circumpolar distribution of polar bears, it's highly unlikely that they will be able to make a living on land.
Well,
that's a shame.
Yeah. Thank you, Kim.
Yeah.
Great question.
Thank you.
And I'm glad I didn't have to ask it. It was great. Margaret, you wanted to talk a little bit about the multi-year ice area where we might, where we're most likely to be able to see this type of habitat that Steve's been talking about, where these are the real polar bears that really roam the ice that are not interbreeding and so forth.
Yeah, well, I think it can be overwhelming for people and discouraging and worrying to think that we are, you know, suddenly all the polar bears are going to disappear. And Steve described how the sea ice changes, not in a uniform fashion. But one of the solutions that World Wildlife Fund is working on with the governments of Greenland and Canada and the Inuit Circumpolar Council and Inuit people in the region, we're working with all these parties in the region where sea ice is expected to linger longer and longest, and that's called the Last Ice Area. It's in the high Canadian Greenlandic archipelago of islands, and Steve described how the currents and the forces of the ocean are moving around to keep ice, the multi-year sea ice, in that area. So we call that the Last Ice Area, and it's one of the solutions that we're looking at in terms of building resilience and contributing to resilience of bears and habitat and people, hopefully, if we can come up with some management and conservation approaches to protecting this area.
So do you think, it sounds like there's some buy-in from the locals on this. In other words, this is not what we've often seen, where there's some outside NGO that comes in and says, hey, look, we have to protect this here and damn the locals.
No, that will never work. And really, that's a very long-term process. We're looking, at a very long-term approach. But really, the best conservation solutions are the ones that are based and rooted in community-based efforts and community buy-in and community leadership. And we've seen that all over the world in places where we work with bears and other wildlife, that people come up with solutions that they know will work for their particular geography, for their culture, and that's what we hope to do in the Last Ice Area.
Yes, go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on Margaret's comment that this is a really important initiative, and it will only come to fruition if we also get on top of greenhouse gas emissions, because ultimately,
yes,
even this last ice area will melt.
Absolutely.
If we stay on our current path.
That's absolutely true. And in December, 195 countries came together and agreed to make commitments to reduce greenhouse gases. But actually, there's still going to be a long way to go after that. So that's the number one problem, and is the greenhouse gas emissions.
Dave Garshelis in Minnesota, is there any particular event at the IBA that you're particularly looking forward to? It looks like a great agenda.
Yeah, well, the
It's sort of broken into different parts, and one would be all the different formal papers that people give, and you can go through the, you know, the program, and you can see all these papers. And, you know, the hard thing is a lot of times there's concurrent sessions, and so you want to see two different papers that are being given at the same time. The other thing would be these public talks in the evening, which even as bear biologists or scientists, I want to go to as many of those as I can. I want to see Steve's, for example. And the third thing is, it's just a great time to get together with people that you haven't seen in a while and interact with people from around the world, some new people, some old friends that we've been seeing for, I mean, I've been in this business for more than 30 years, and so you get to see people about once every year and a half, or sometimes less frequently than that, and it's really important to sit down in small groups or just to have dinner with people and chat about what's going on, what they've been doing for research and things like that.
Yeah, and even your grad students must have graduate students now.
That's exactly true. One of my graduate students from Taiwan, for example, she's a professor there, and she's bringing four of her students over.
Yeah. Well, is there, I guess while we're talking about the agenda here, Steve Amstrup, when are you giving your talk?
My talk is Monday night at 8 o'clock.
And Richard Nelson is...
Yeah, this is just... I really hope that people in Anchorage come out for this. It's going to be at the Dena'ina Center. Steve's presentation is on Monday night. Richard Nelson is going to talk about the Koyukon Indian teachings around the black bear. We have our panda expert is going to speak on Wednesday night. There are going to be two presentations and stories and experts speaking about bear attacks on Tuesday, all at the Dena'ina Center. So really lots of fascinating and entertaining informational, educational, fun presentations.
And, of course, coming up this week. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, and my talk precedes the panda talk. I think mine's at 7 o'clock on Wednesday.
Great,
right.
Great.
Yeah. And we have music, too, right?
Music. Not sure about music.
Oh, we get Ray Troll.
Oh, right. That's at the end of the week. Yep.
he's gonna be the closing. He's going to knock it out of the park. I don't know if he'll do music or what he'll do. You never know with that guy.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. You know, it's the IBA. When do you think we'll see it again? How many years was it?
It was 95 was the last time it was in Alaska, right. So it might be something like that.
Another
again.
Another 20 years? Yeah. Well, it seems like we got a lot of bear stuff up here. I might want to step that schedule up a little bit. Margaret, you're going to be pretty busy then.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be a lot of fun.
It rotates around the world, Steve, so that people can, you know, in other places of the world, it becomes more local there. So actually the next one is next year, November of 2017 in Quito, Ecuador, and then it moves to Slovenia.
Wow. Well, I want to thank everybody, Steve Amstrup, Dave Garshelis, and Margaret Williams for being with us on this show. I want to thank the callers who have helped making this possible, and IBA. Looks like it's going to be a great event. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Steve.
I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by GCI, an Alaska-born and raised company connecting Alaskans from the Aleutian to the Arctic, from the North Slope to Southeast, and to the rest of the world. With more than 2,000 employees statewide, a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering, over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to four-year colleges or other post-secondary education. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.